I think everybody out there has these experiences where we feel like we could have done more, we should have done more, and yet we did what we could at the time. And so I'd ask your people in your audience, who are your Anthonys? Who are the stories that you're carrying around that you say, I wasn't good enough, or I didn't do everything I could, when actually you did? You did your best.
Hi, everyone. Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today, we're talking all things fear with brain surgeon, Dr. Mark McLaughlin. He's here to help us unpack fear and understand the lessons that he's taken from all his years studying the brain and being in a high-stress environment as a brain surgeon, where every move you're about to make is crucial and could potentially result in the death of somebody that you're working on. I mean, that's a lot of fear and anxiety to work with, and a lot of pressure on one human being. So I bet he has a lot to teach us. In fact, I know he has a lot to teach us when it comes to how the brain works and how we can embrace fear. It's not about not having fear. It's about embracing fear and using it as a tool to make our goals and dreams happen. This is a fascinating conversation. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Dr. Mark McLaughlin. Dr. Mark McLaughlin is a practicing board-certified neurosurgeon, a national media commenter, thought leader in performance enhancement, and the author of the book Cognitive Dominance, A Brain Surgeon's Quest to Outthink Fear. Dr. McLaughlin, thank you for being here and welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. You know, there's this classic phrase, which many of our listeners know. It's used to describe when something isn't difficult. You know, people will say, well, that's not brain surgery. Don't overthink it. But I'd argue that the topic of fear is kind of like brain surgery for a lot of people. It's very complicated. They don't understand it. They don't understand where it originates from. They don't know where it lives in the brain. And so I'm looking forward to unpacking it with you on this topic. But I'm curious, for you, for life growing up, what was your relationship to fear as a child?
Well, I was lucky. I had a wonderful childhood. I had wonderful parents, mom and dad, hugely supportive. And really, I think the first time I got introduced to fear, you know, in a laboratory kind of setting, was my wrestling career. That to me is, you know, when you are on the edge of the mat and you're about to ready to go out and compete against somebody who looks maybe a little bigger than you, or a little stronger than you, or a little older than you, and you're out there alone without anybody else helping you. That's when I first started experiencing fear. So that's sort of when I realized, hey, this is something I'm going to have to deal with in my life, and I'm going to have to wrestle with it both on the mat and off the mat. So that's when it first started. And then, of course, as you know, as college and athletics went on, it continued. But really, once I got into neurosurgery, I started realizing, like, wow, this is really stressful. There's a lot of like really important decisions riding here, and I can't make mistakes. And so it was, you know, the biggest fear I had as a young doctor was, gosh, you know, am I fully prepared? Could I make all the right decisions? Do I have all the information? And I didn't want to make a mistake. I didn't want to harm somebody. So that's when the fear got really on a high level end.
Let's talk about the relationship between the wrestling, and you eventually became a Hall of Famer. You're in the Hall of Fame for wrestling at the collegiate level. And what was the relationship, and what did you learn from your mentors and coaches in wrestling, and compare and contrast that to being a young doctor and the mentors that were in that space? What did they teach you, and what did they talk about when it came to fear? Let's start with wrestling first.
Well, it was the mental game. You know, we all talk about sports and how, yeah, there's a certain amount of physical nature that you need to have, athletic ability, drilling, you know, hard work, but it's really a mental game. Most sports are, and so is medicine, so is surgery. So there's a lot of things that we do. So I think probably the greatest thing I learned from wrestling from my coaches was really concentration, like how to focus on something really intently and not allow distractions interfere with your plan from where you are to where you want to be. And from that, I got to hone it in neurosurgery because, you know, you spend hours, you know, shaving bone spurs off of a nerve or opening up the skull in a certain way to get exactly to where you need to on a brain tumor. And it can take hours to do that. And so you just need to focus on every single step along the way. I'd imagine it's like rock climbing. It's a lot like any kind of elite sport where you just have to focus on the immediate matter at hand and then move to the next step.
In med school and eventually in your training to be a brain surgeon, would they use the word fear? Was it clearly used and said that this is something that you should plan on happening to you? It's not just about the education and understanding the correct way to make the cut, but would they prepare you for the fact that fear was going to be a primary component in your practice?
Fear was seldom discussed in training and in medical school. And I think it's something we really need to focus on more for pre-med students and medical students to really cope. I mean, you're trained, you have this incredible experience in training to take care of people, but you're not taught a lot about the feelings and emotions that you're going to have. And so it's something we need to focus on more. Absolutely.
You know, I think that piggybacks into your book. You know, you open up the book and you talk about the story, you talk about a couple stories, but there's this one story about a young boy, I believe it was, Anthony, that you worked on that was very pivotal in your relationship to fear and just your own personal journey with it. Would you mind just sharing briefly about that introductory story and what relevance it has in the material that you started putting together and your own relationship with fear?
Sure, sure. Early on in my career, really in the first month or so, I had had some incredible saves and was really flying high, you know, thinking this is great. I just finished all my training and I'm on top of the world here and I'm going to ride off into the sunset and be a neurosurgeon and live all my dreams. I came across a young boy in the emergency room who had a brain tumor. And he was just this really neat kid. He had a great sense of humor and cute young 8-year-old boy. And I became attached to him immediately. And I was, you know, I was focused on his tumor and I knew I had all the training to fix him. And I took him to the operating room and I did a perfect operation. Yet he just had multiple complications after the surgery. And at the time, I was really turned me upside down because I saw this beautiful boy that I thought I could save. And then I really felt like I could deliver him back to his parents as a normal child. And I just saw him sort of slip through my fingers with one complication after another. He got an infection and he got a fluid buildup. And then his tumor came back, his pathology came back malignant. And it was one of those one by one by one to just see this terrible cascade. And, you know, I questioned myself. I thought, what, did you do something wrong with the surgery? Could you have done it quicker? Could you have done it better? Could you have recognized these complications sooner? Could you have done less retraction that maybe didn't cause these kinds of complications? And I really struggled with that. And I said to myself, like, this is not what I expected to feel when I finished my residency. I knew neurosurgery was risky business, but I didn't believe I'd feel terrible and feel like it was my fault that this child wasn't doing well. And lo and behold, I really didn't deal with that well. You know, when he went on, he ultimately stabilized and he went on to go to rehabilitation, but I didn't get better. He stabilized, but I got worse. And I kept thinking about, wow, you know, what if this happens again? I don't know if I can work on a child again. I don't know if I can deal with this feeling. I come home every day feeling like I could have done something differently maybe. And I internalized that and had very poor coping strategies, didn't focus on it, didn't share it with my loved ones. And I probably should have gotten some help and talked to some people about it in retrospect, but I didn't. In fact, I avoided pediatric neurosurgery. I ultimately stopped doing pediatric neurosurgery. And I always felt like I had failed Anthony and his parents along the way. And not until I started writing my book and looking at the picture of Anthony that I kept on my wall all those years, every time I saw, I had a picture of Anthony in his bedside, and every time I walked by it, it made me sad. And then when I was writing my book, I thought, I got to find out what happened to Anthony. I got to, you know, see where he is now. And I really thought he had passed away based upon all of the problems that he had had and the pathology. But lo and behold, I came across his family's restaurant on the internet. And sure enough, this 8-year-old boy is now a 24-year-old man, and he's with his mom and dad. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And I drove up to the family store that weekend. I went to the restaurant and I saw him and his parents. And I told him, I said, gosh, I've been thinking about you for 15 years. And I always felt like I let you guys down. And his parents just jumped around the table and gave me this great hug. And they said, what are you talking about? You saved our boy. He's still our number one guy here at the pizza parlor. And you did everything you could. You released your gift for us. And we're thrilled, you know. And I realized I had been telling myself this story that I could have done something more, when really I couldn't. I did everything I could. I did my skill, utilized my skills to the best of my ability. And I did release my gift for him. And it was a huge eye-opening experience for me. And it was neat because my co-writer, Sean Coyne, told me, hey, let's put some of the success stories in with Anthony's story. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense, Sean. Here are the success stories of me saving somebody from a spinal cord injury. How can we put that in with Anthony? And he said, Mark, you don't see it, do you? And I was like, no, what? He said, well, when you do something, when something good happens, when some great success comes, you attribute that to luck. And when somebody you do everything for doesn't go well, you say it's your fault. That's an impossible standard to live up to.
Mm.
That was a huge eye-opener for me. And I think everybody out there has these experiences where we feel like we could have done more, we should have done more, and yet we did what we could at the time. And so I'd ask your people in your audience, who are your Anthonys? Who are the stories that you're carrying around that you say, I wasn't good enough, or I didn't do everything I could, when actually you did. You did your best.
And you know, you're using a very powerful word here, which is story. So much of what we experience as fear is wrapped up often in a story. And it takes a deliberate unpacking to really understand the real relationship. So I want to start at the beginning, and I want to take some of the concepts that you've beautifully outlined in the framework that you've put together in the book. And I want to go one by one and unpack some of these things so that we can really understand, what is fear? Where does it live in the brain? Why is it useful? And then when does it become can become a challenge? So let's start off first with talking about, what's the fear freak out problem? Can you define that the way you've shared inside the book?
That's sort of when, so I would say we start there's anticipated bad events, and then there's actual bad events. So there's anticipated things we think about. Like, so we hear some rustling outside our back door and we think, ooh, there could be an intruder. Then somebody kicks in the door and you have an intruder in your house. That's a totally different level of fear. So the fear freak out is when you are faced with something that is an unexpected event in your life that you do not know what to do about. For me, it was Anthony. I didn't know how to deal with this feeling of guilt and remorse and anxiety and a level of fear that maybe I didn't perform up to my best abilities. For other people, it can be, you know, stage fright, or it can be not functioning at a high level in a business meeting, or getting emotional when you really need to think calmly. So really, the first thing we got to do is we defined as a fear gradient. So we ask ourselves, when do we not have fear? Okay, so when do we not have fear? We're not anticipating any unexpected event. We're not thinking about that. We're actually just functioning. That's when we experience transcendence. That's when we experience flow. That's when we can do no wrong. That's when our brain doesn't need to think. It just needs to act. And once you start thinking, you start messing up that flow pattern. But we start experiencing anxiety and fear when an unexpected event pops into our mind that we think might happen. You know, did I flub the last three questions on my exam? Did I close the, for me, it'd be, you know, did I close the wound as tightly as I wanted it to be closed? Everybody has that sort of question. And then beyond that, when you come to the fear freak out concept, that's when something bad is actually happening. You realize, there's a problem here. We have there's a wild animal in the campsite and we got to get out of the campsite, whatever that happens to be. So these are the kinds of levels of fear that we have. And being able to identify that is one of the first steps.
And so let's take, for instance, so the listeners can follow along. You know, you had this moment with Anthony, as you talk about inside the book, and that not only was a moment that you experienced, but also how you handled that impacted your relationship to performing that type of surgery in the future. So where does that live in it? Where does our past story and our feeling of how well or not well, in the case of fear, it went, impact our future behavior or resistance towards doing something?
So I would say, I took a page from Jordan Peterson's book, Maps of Meaning, and 12 Rules, which are both excellent books, but Maps of Meaning really is a powerful book. And what he talks about is, you know, everybody's on our path from what is, where we are in our life, to where we expect us to be, where we think we should be in the future. So that's the future. That's what we're aiming for. And we're all performing actions along the way to get to where we want to be. And along the way, what happens is these things, these unexpected events come our way. They get thrown our way. And they can be, these are events that are what we call in the book fear, P-H-E-R-E-S, fears. They are events that that are transformative. They can be destructive or they can be creative. And my co-writer Sean coined the term fear. So fear is the emotion that you experience when you have a P-H-E-R-E, a fear event. A fear event is something that's thrown your way. It's something that is unexpected and you're not sure whether it's consistent with the goal that you're moving forward. Whether you get an F on an exam or you don't get the job evaluation that you thought you were going to get. And so now your future is in question. Am I on the right path to get to my goal? So then what we talk about is you need to break that fear event down. So what the first thing you need to do is, what are the objective and subjective components of it? So we need to kind of break it down into two categories. What's objective about it? So what are the scientific facts? What are the realities of it? So that's important. And then what are the subjective concepts is really kind of, what is the meaning of this to me? Okay.
The story that we've created around something.
Exactly. And what do we value in truth? So let's talk about, like, say the COVID crisis. Okay. What do we know? What are the objective facts? Okay. Well, we have a highly contagious virus that is fatal or very, very dangerous in some people. We know that it's all over the world. We know that it's paralyzed the world economy. Those are facts that I don't think are completely indisputable all over the world. Then it's the sub, those are objective. Then it's, what are the subjective? Oh my God, I'm going out of business. Okay. My life is going to be changed forever. I'm never going to be able to go out and feel comfortable again. Okay. Well, those are, let's break those down. How many of those are, what are those real? Are some of those your meanings that you've assigned to them that are not really, yes, the world will be different, but it's maybe going to be stronger. Maybe it's going to be more well-equipped to deal with a worse pandemic in the future. So you need to break out the objective and subjective components of it. Then you need to ask yourself, is this a tool or an obstacle? And so in other words, is this useful for me? And then am I familiar with it? Is it known or is it completely unknown? And if you can assign a valence to each of those, you can literally map out your fear. And that's what we propose that we do. So if you take like a crosshair and you just write a horizontal and a vertical line, the horizontal line is the subjective axis. And I'm sorry, the vertical axis is the subjective axis and the horizontal line is the objective axis. We can break events down and say, what's positive, what's negative? Is it known or unknown? And is it an obstacle or a tool? So, I give an example of a scientist, Ramon y Cajal. He was the most famous neuropathologist in the world. And he won the Nobel Prize in 1935 for discovering the synapse. And so he's as a child, sort of a rambunctious child, and his father forces him to go to medical school, but he wanted to be an artist. So he's got this incredible artistic ability, and he realizes, I'm going to study neuropathology. So he starts looking under the microscope, and he sees all these beautiful structures under the microscope, and he starts drawing them. So he's got this skill set, and he wants to learn about the neurosciences, but he's having trouble looking at nerve cells. And lo and behold, a friend of his comes back from an Italian conference, and he shows him these silver stains that Camillo Golgi, the Golgi body, remember the Golgi body in high school? Camillo Golgi has stained, which show neurons, nerve cells perfectly. So here's this guy who's this incredible artist who sees a new technique, and he's trained in it. So it's known to him. It's subjectively of value to him because he wanted to do it, and he's objectively good at it. Boom, boom, boom. That's positive, positive, positive. That immediately puts this man into a positive quadrant where he can act out everything that he's wanted to, and he discovers the neuron synapse, and he wins the Nobel Prize and changes the world. So this is this kind of transformative element that I'm talking about, this event. He sees the silver stain. He realizes that he can change the world with the silver stain. And he goes out and he does it. Mm. That's the transformative event.
It's powerful. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the brain. You know, you've said in previous interviews that the brain is kind of like an operating system built on an operating system built on an operating system. There's so many layers that are there, right, which is often why we need to develop frameworks when it comes to tackling fear, because different parts of our brain deal with fear, you know, a little bit differently. Can you help give us the lay of the land of the brain and where fear basically resides?
Sure. I mean, in a short answer is that it resides in the amygdala. So it's in one of the most primitive areas of the brain. And it is an area that I call brain 1.0. So it's like our first version of our fear module. And it's an incredibly important and efficient system that alerts you towards danger. And it alerts you towards unexpected events, which is why your brain 1.0 will give you a jolt of fear, whether there's a lion in your campground or whether somebody is criticizing your report in the boardroom. So you get this jolt of fear from your amygdala, and that sends us an impulse to your neocortex. Your neocortex then is the area of your brain, the higher level of your brain, the planning and the executive function that needs to sort that out. And that's the key function. That's what cognitive dominance is. It's really sorting out what needs immediate emergency attention, like there's a fire in the house and you got to go find out where it needs, you know, don't go turn the fire alarm off, go put the fire out. That's the important thing. Or whether it's something that cognitively we need to think more. So like I said, when Cajal, the scientist, the neuroscientist, what he's got positive objective, positive subjective tool, and he knows it, he's in flow. That's when your brain 1.0 is functioning on all cylinders and you don't have to think. It just let your body do. But in every other one of those quadrants, when you have something objectively that's positive but subjectively negative, let's say you get a job promotion and then you realize suddenly that the job you got promoted to is miserable and the person you're working for is a terrible boss and you realize this isn't really the best situation for you. Then, so objectively you've gotten something positive, but subjectively it's negative. That's when you got to use your brain 2.0, that higher level executive software, to kind of think through, all right, how am I going to get through this? Is this a temporary thing? Is it a permanent thing? Do I need to rethink my job? Do I need to rethink my career? Moving forward, let's say you get something that's objectively negative and subjectively negative. You get a diagnosis of cancer, you know, there's nothing good about that in any way, shape, or form, right? That's where you're in the all is lost quadrant. That's something that's really, really something you need to dig deeply and say, oh my gosh, like, how am I going to get myself out of this? What are my resources to kind of get through this? And then there are other events where subjectively, objectively something's negative, but subjectively it's positive. So in other words, you know, you have a something in your business that hits your business that you think is going to be really bad, but it turns out to be the best thing that ever happened to you because you reinvent yourself. That's what I call the birthing a new skill set quadrant. That's when your objective fear event is negative and your subjective fear event is positive. So that's when you learn that new skill set and then you move back into the flow. So this clockwise flow from flow to calm before the storm to all is lost to birthing a new skill set. And it's the heroic journey of life that we all travel through. We don't always go in that clockwise fashion. Sometimes we drop right down into the all is lost quadrant, or sometimes we're in the birthing a new skill set quadrant. But it's that constant flow that helps us. And fear is when you don't know where you are on that map. So the map is something that helps you calm your amygdala down so that you can think through what the event is and how you can best function with it.
If you were a mentor to you, right? Let's say there's two of you. There's you who has the knowledge and information that you have right now and understands the process of cognitive dominance and could go back in time and you'd sit there and be a mentor to yourself when you were operating and the aftermath that happened with the patient Anthony, and you were feeling the emotions that you felt after seeing him for months suffer in agony, feeling like he's not getting better, maybe in certain cases he's getting worse. What would you, using this framework, told yourself at that time of what would be a possibility to step into and how to apply this process to that situation you were in?
Sure. A couple of things. First, I would have fallen back on one of my old neurosurgical adages I learned a long time ago, and that is never worry about a patient alone. That was one of our rules in neurosurgery. Never worry about a patient alone. Get other people to help you think about this. Talk about it. Get some help. It's like getting a second opinion. When you get other people involved, they can give you different perspectives. You have more choices on the menu of options to choose. So never worry about a patient alone, Mark. Think about this with other people. Share it, number one. Number two, you're in a risky business and you got to do the best you can, and that's all you can do. And number three, you are serving someone. Serve them the best way you can. Focus on this as something that you can do every single day to make this a little better and stop focusing on what could have been, what should have been in the past.
When you look at the first one, which is one of these principles, and there's so many, you know, great ones that you have from you know, your training in surgery. When you look at that first principle, I'm curious, what are some of the same reasons? You know, in your instance, you're talking about never worry about a patient alone. But for everybody who's here, who's not a doctor or doing surgery, it's also never worry about a problem alone. Go seek counsel for the right people. What do you think prevents people? Because that seems so obvious, but what prevents us from not going out and seeking the counsel of other people when it comes to a problem that can sometimes feel too big for us to get our hands around?
That is a great question. And what I would say is, I think it's a fear of vulnerability. It's a fear that you're going to seem silly or you're going to look bad. And it's a human reaction to protect yourself. It's actually a self-protective mechanism. It's part of what I talk about later in the book about called the I-RISE concept. When a catastrophe happens, our first reaction is to cover our bases, is to run, it's to hide, it's to pull out, it's to get away. That's an immediate reaction that you must suppress. You have to suppress that because it almost always is the wrong reaction in unless it's a life or death situation. But I would say that that I think it's the vulnerability, and people don't realize that when you're vulnerable, it strengthens you. It doesn't weaken you. It strengthens you. And it's something that we have to focus on more. I think that if you do that, if you share it with people, you're going to find out that five or six or seven other people have the same problem. I mean, Carl Jung said once, you know, anyone's individual problem is relevant to society because if he shares that with other people and a solution is achieved, that's going to benefit all of society. So we have to realize that our problems are not unique. They're universal. They've been around for thousands of years. You can pick up, you know, Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius. They struggled with the same questions and the same problems we had.
And I think, unfortunately, with the education system that we have that's very much focused on individual efforts and less about collaboration, as a general statement on education in the world, I think a lot of people come into situations and just sort of feel like it's all on me. I have to figure it out by myself because that's what we were designed and we were trained to do. And here you are saying that that's not always going to help you get through the fear. In fact, when you're stuck, that's the perfect opportunity to bring in other individuals into the picture.
Exactly. And it's going to be likely going to have more potential for solution.
You know, we talked about when we were chit-chatting earlier, but right before we started, the mutual admiration of Stephen Pressfield, who's written many books, and you said they've been inspirational to you. And I know you guys are on the same press and same editor and everything like that, same team that's working on. And a few weeks ago, I had shared a quote on my Instagram and social media from Stephen Pressfield on the topic of fear. And I want to share that quote and, you know, follow up with a question with you on it. So the question that was there, and this is from a book, I believe, Turning Pro, that Stephen Pressfield wrote. He says, "The amateur believes he must first overcome his fear, then he can do all his work. The professional knows that fear can never be overcome. He knows that there's no such thing as a fearless warrior or a dread-free artist." So much of what I love about these principles of never worry about a patient alone and some of the other ones you mentioned is that sometimes there's still this misconception in society that we have to get over our fear and that there's some individuals that live in a fearless world, right? That there's people that are out there that just don't experience fear at all. In your deep dive into fear and unpacking it, what have you known and what have you learned about that statement about it being, you know, true or not true?
Yeah, I think fearless people are dangerous. I mean, imagine the things we would do if we didn't have fear. It is an incredibly helpful emotion for us to have. We need to have it. It's universal, and any person who cares about things is going to have fear. It's interesting. My partner was just reading, one of my partners at Prince and Brain Spine, Matt Tormenti, was reading a book by Tom Starzl, who's really the world's greatest transplant surgeon at the University of Pittsburgh, and he built the World Center for that. And Starzl said that even before every surgery, he was so fearful that he literally could barely talk to people before the surgery because all he was thinking about is every single step along the way, what he needed to do. He needed to review his old notes and make sure that nothing was missed. And he, you know, it's just, here's the world's greatest transplant surgeon saying the same thing. I was afraid and barely functional until I got to the OR because of what I was thinking about. We need to think about it in that way. Now, it needs to be modulated. It needs to be thought about, and we need to use that. You know, the amygdala is what I call the deployment software. That's when you're looking around, you're thinking about everything, you're looking for, you know, furtive movements, and that's the kind of, you know, military software that we have installed that we need to have for protective mechanisms when we're walking down the street at night and a stranger starts following us, right? That's important. That's the gift of fear that, you know, that has been well described. But we also need that neocortex to really unpack it in environments where we know we're safe, but we're experiencing the same primitive emotion. It's universal. Everybody has it, but we can outthink it. We can outthink it.
And I think that's the power in the book that I, you know, that I feel that you've written with Cognitive Dominance, is that it's how to outthink it the same way that we would train for anything. If we would train for a marathon, there's going to be techniques. There's things that we're going to bring in. We're not just going to get up one day and just start running for a marathon. We're probably going to get injured that way, or we're going to get exhausted and we're going to give up. But we forget that so often in life when it comes to things like having a difficult conversation with someone, when it comes to the fear that people have of presenting a presentation at work. You know, these fears are real and our body experiences them as real, but we can also train and think through them. So on that topic of thinking and preparing for them, I'd love to talk about, I believe it was the five P's or the four P's that you have inside the book and its relationship and where it fits in this framework that you've developed.
Sure. The way I deal with it is with routines. So if you develop routines and you make them sort of automatic, you're going to set your body and your mind in motion. And, you know, I love Tim McGraw just had a great book called Grit and Grace. And I don't know if he coined the term, but it is definitely the fact that your motion determines your emotion. Your motion determines your emotion. So for my P's, whenever I'm doing any surgery, I pause. I think about exactly who that patient is and why they came to me, whether they've been having trouble picking up their grandchild or they're dragging their foot when they go for a walk and they realize that they're having progressive weakness in their leg. Once I think about the patient, I think about the procedure step by step, exactly what I'm going to do. I go through it in my mind. Then I put out a positive thought. You know, this is your place and time to do this. You're trained to do this. This is a privilege. Be thankful for where you are and that you can help this person and what you do. And then lastly, I say a prayer. And a prayer for me is something that's always changing me. It's always making me stronger. And I believe it makes me a better surgeon. So the five P's are something that I do every time. And you know, when I'm doing that positive thought, I'm always thinking about the why. Why am I doing medicine? Why am I performing, you know, surgery? I'm doing this because I want to help people. I want to serve people. You know, and that'd be another thing I would tell my younger self is the Nietzsche quote, which is anyone can endure a what as long as you have a why. Hmm. Your why, Mark, is being a doctor and serving this young boy in whatever way he needs.
So a couple technical questions on just that system. For the positive thought and prayer for yourself personally, are those things that you say out loud? Do you write them down? Or do you just simply think them to yourself?
I think them almost always. I don't usually, won't really say that aloud.
And is there any challenge to saying it out loud if somebody was applying it to what they were doing themselves? Or do you do it more out of state that you're just around other people in the operating room? And so it's maybe best suited for you to think it internally rather than saying it out loud where other people could hear you.
I know some great surgeons who say prayers aloud before they do surgery. Dr. Beth Dupree, she's a world-renowned breast surgeon out in Sedona. And so whatever works for you. I think that just for me, it's always been kind of more of a private internal space. There's a lot of things going on in the operating room. There's a lot of you know, noises. And so I try and just calm it down and really get down to the meat of why I'm here. Why is this person here? How can I get them back to picking their grandchild up or going for a walk with their wife? That's what I want to do. And then move on to the plan, positive thought, and the prayer.
When we go from something like surgery and we switch over to something that you've also done, which is writing a book, how would you think about, or how did you think about the five P's in the context of your routine and rituals through the writing process, which can bring up a lot of fears and insecurities?
Well, again, that goes back to Steve Pressfield's War of Art. You know, I mean, he really talks about how, you know, if you want your muse to come to you, if you want the spirit that guides your creative light to arrive, you got to show up every single day for it and be regular about it. And so that was an important part of, for me, was I really focused on every day. I got up at 5. I wrote from sort of 5:30 to 7 and was very diligent about it for really about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, anybody who's written a book knows, you know, you've written it 100 times and you excise so many different comments that, and versions. So it was a long process, but it was truly the dedication. And that was something that wrestling helped me too, the determination to actually get it done. So that was huge. I had a huge, coach in my camp with Sean Coyne, who was really helped me get along. And so I had a lot of help along the way. It was not something I did on my own.
There's so many, again, of those lessons that you took from surgery that we can apply into our world. And I want to bring out a quote that I pulled from your book that I just thought was fantastic for this next question that we're about to set up. And the quote says, "The most important bite is the one you are about to take." Unpack that quote, what it means, and how it relates to the world of fear.
Sure, sure. So when we're doing spine surgery, we use an instrument called a Carison Rondure. And it sort of looks like it looks almost like a handgun. It has two bars to it that with a spring on it. So you squeeze it almost like a trigger, but you're using your hand. And then it has a long neck that almost kind of looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex with a mouth that closes. And that mouth is very sharp. It has sharp edges to it. And you use it to shave off bone spurs that develop over time as people age. What happens is bone spurs will develop and they'll pinch nerves. So a lot of my time in spine surgery is dedicated to shaving off these bone spurs. And, you know, these are 2 and 3 millimeter and sometimes 1 millimeter bites that I'm taking. Each one of those little bites, when I squeeze it, I'm within 1 millimeter of a person's nerve that's going to their leg, going to their foot, lifting the nerve that lifts their foot up when they walk or pushes it down. So what I say is that every single one of those bites is critical. And if I turn the mouth of that instrument 1 or 2 millimeters to the left too much or to the right too much or a millimeter deep, and I grab the nerve root, I can change somebody's life forever. So you need to focus on every single time you close that. You need to know exactly what's in the mouth of that instrument. Dr. Ginetta, one of my mentors, always told me, never cut what you can't see. Never cut what you can't see. Never close the mouth of that instrument unless you see everything. And when you're doing an operation, sometimes I'll pull that trigger 500, 600 times in one operation over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, it's easy for you to let your mind wander when you're doing that. It can get repetitive. Repetitive activities, our brain likes to kind of go on autopilot. You can't go on autopilot when you're closing a Carison Rondure on somebody's around somebody's nerve root. You need to focus on every single bite. So I don't like any chit-chat in my operating room. I don't like people talking about things, you know, other than exactly what we're doing at that time. And what I tell people is, hey, I'm working on the next bite. That's the next bite. That's the most important bite, not the bite before, not the bite later, but the bite I'm about to take is the most important bite. And so it's a concentration technique. It's almost meditative to really focus on that. And it brings me to the Rudyard Kipling quote: "If you can treat with meet triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same." You can't be thinking about how great this patient's going to be after surgery while you're taking the bite. And you can't be worried about pulling the nerve root up. You have to just be focused on closing the mouth of that rondure or on the bone spur and not on the nerve every single time. So thinking about how well somebody's going to do is triumph, or thinking about how bad you could injure somebody is disaster. You can't, they're imposters. They don't live in the present. You have to be in the present moment when you close that rondure.
Yeah, it's such a powerful phrase and really a lesson that comes in, because so many times when we see that either fear or distraction comes in, it's something that we're caught up in the past or it's some projection of the future. We're not here in this moment where we're just taking it one step at a time. If somebody has a fear of public speaking or feel like they gave a talk one time and it didn't go right, even if it's to a small audience, and then they're in that room and they're about to do this thing that they prepared for, that they practiced on. But if the mind goes towards the past or if it starts projecting the future, that's often when I can see that somebody's lost their train of thought or gets distracted and isn't here just focused on the next most important thing that they have. That's the matter at hand in this moment.
Exactly.
Another important lesson that I want to pick out of the book, and you know, I want to start off first by talking about the fight or flight system and its connection to the brain. We've done many episodes where different people have talked about fight or flight in terms of stress, in terms of in terms of health conditions that can happen inside of the body, in terms of trauma that's there, you know. And we've also talked about fight, flight, or freeze, right? There's also freeze as a natural response. The idea of basically evolutionary playing dead, you know, a bear comes to attack you, can't fight, you can't flight. Sometimes animals play dead, right? And that's one way that maybe the bear or the tiger or whatever might potentially leave them alone. In the book, you talk about one of the ways to break through this response system that's baked into our brain and our amygdala is the idea of taking tiny actions in the right direction, taking tiny actions consistently in the right direction towards where we want to go. What's the power of tiny actions when it comes to fear and big fears that we're facing in our life?
Well, it's tiny actions in the direction that we subjectively believe is who we are. So that's the key to it, especially when you're in this all is lost quadrant. When let's say you get something, all is lost is when you do everything right and something terrible still happens. So it's like the Anthony experience, you know? It's when you do everything right and still it doesn't come out good. And what do you got to do in that situation? You got to say, like, what do I value most deeply? And what's the one thing I can do to get a little bit closer to that? That's spending time with a loved one, most likely. Telling somebody you love them. Making somebody's pain a little bit easier. Doing a little task that can just help them in some small way. Whatever it is. That's gonna give you a jolt of serotonin, which is a feel good chemical, and it's also going to decrease your amygdala's signaling of fear. So that's the first step in getting yourself out of a hole, whatever it is.
So much of fear is catching ourselves in the process of starting to build up the fear that's there. When you look at all the techniques that you bring in and the awareness that you have, still to this date, I'm sure there are different moments where you experience fear in different aspects of life. What are some of the first bodily sensations or things that you notice that start to happen when it bubbles up inside of you?
Well, I tell a story in the book about a nice gentleman who presented with a brain tumor that had a lot of swelling. And it was in an area that I had done many times before, but I hadn't done recently. I hadn't done in the last year or two because we had brought on a new surgeon who was really a specialist in this area. And so he had been taking most of those cases, but he was away. And this patient needed surgery, and I couldn't wait for next week for my partner to get back, and I had to do the surgery. So I was doing a surgery that I was confident that I could do, but it was a higher stress level surgery and something that, you know, I hadn't done in a while. On top of it, maybe an hour before I did the surgery, I got a call from my father's physician who told me my father had leukemia and a very bad form of it that was not going to result in him doing well at all. And I was just stymied for, you know, 5-10 minutes. I was sitting in my car going, how, you can't do surgery. Like, you got to go see your dad. He just heard this diagnosis. You know, how, I don't think I'll be able to do the surgery. And I seriously thought about canceling it or postponing it. But it had already been delayed one day because we were transferring him and there was some difficulty in getting an optimal situation. So it had already had some delays and it wasn't going to be any better to do it the next day. In fact, it was going to put him at risk for another night that he could have problems. And I sort of puzzled on it and pondered on it for a while. And then what I said to myself is, gosh darn it, I'm going to dedicate this operation to my dad. I mean, he would not want me to cancel the surgery. He'd be like, what if that was me? You got to go do that. You know, get in there, get yourself together, go do what you need to do. You're trained to do it and you come see me later. I mean, I didn't talk with him, but that was sort of the conversation I had with my own my mind was go in there, put some scrubs on, go see the patient, take a big breath, ask yourself again, can I do this? Yes, I can do this. I can put my mind at ease. I can dedicate this surgery to Dad because that's what he would want. And I'm going to make this the best surgery I've ever done. So for me, it's trying to find that thread that's going to get you through the moment. And you can find it. It's just looking deeply at what is most meaningful to you. And, you know, I don't think I even ever told my dad that I dedicated that surgery to him, but he knows.
That's powerful. You know, when fear becomes all encompassing and it starts to take us over and our mind goes in different directions, there's different techniques you talk about just grounding ourselves and reorienting ourselves when we aren't sure what to do. And one of those techniques is reading the room. Can you talk about what that is and how somebody could use it in their own life when they are faced with a challenge that starts to be a little bit disorienting?
Sure. This was another surgery that I was involved in where I was coming down on this area where I was, this is a different patient, but I was coming down in an area where I expected to land right on top of the tumor. And I had, this was a very intricate surgery and we had placed everything properly and I was right where I thought I should be. And I was about to remove, you know, land on the tumor and remove it. And there was no tumor there. I looked up, forward, backward, a little bit deeper. I couldn't see. All I saw was normal tissue. So for a moment, I was just in my mind, I was just like, what's going on here? You know, I was in an internal sort of state of alarm. Excuse me. I went back to the scan and I looked at the scan and there was the tumor. And I asked myself a series of questions, you know, am I on the right side of the head? Yes. Am I where I think the tumor should be? Yes. Could the tumor have changed in 3 days since the scan? Well, maybe, but probably not likely. Could I have punctured the tumor or the cyst and changed the shape of it during my entry? Yes, that's possible. But as I look back in again, I still was looking at normal brain tissue. So this entire conversation that I was having was in my head. And what I did was I took a step back. And, you know, I told everybody in the room, you know, I'm not seeing what I expect to see here. This is unusual. I have a scan over here, which shows a 1.5 centimeter tumor right in the area of the foramen Monroe, which is where I believe I'm at. And we're just going to take it from the top, everybody. And we're going to go down slowly from the scalp all the way down. And we're going to walk through this. And so then I had my scrub nurse and my circulator and the anesthesiologist and myself looking at the screen. They're looking at the microscope screen. So I'm looking through a microscope and they're looking at the screen. And I just started with, okay, here's scalp. Here's the subcutaneous tissues. Here's the skull. Okay, now I'm going through the skull. And here's the covering, the meninges, which is the covering of the brain. And here's my entry into the brain surface. Here's the frontal lobe here, and we're moving farther down. Here's the white matter. We passed the gray matter. Here's the white matter. And here I am where I thought the tumor would be. Let's look a little bit in front, a little bit in back, a little bit deeper. I went a little bit deeper, and then all of a sudden I popped right onto the abnormal tissue. And I was like, ah, here it is. I gotcha. And that talking to the room, and it was funny because I told Sanjay Gupta of the experience. I had a chance to interview Sanjay Gupta, and he described it as narrating the room. And I didn't have a name for it. I was like, that's great. Can I use that? He's like, sure, no problem. So that narrating of the room helped me get online with things. And it helped me, instead of feeling alone, I felt like I was part of a team and everybody was there kind of rooting for me. And I wasn't trying to hide something from them. I was being vulnerable again. And, you know, another thing I've learned over the last 20 years is you can't be great without partnership. if you want to achieve greatness, you need partners. You need people that are rooting for you and people that can help you. And they may have a suggestion that can get you through something. And just feeling like they were all with me on that got me through it.
You know, that narrating the room is such a powerful tool. I didn't know that I'd been doing it for years. Whenever I encounter something where I'm not sure exactly the next step is, whether I'm with my team or whether I'm by myself individually driving and then a worry comes up or an email or something that I'm trying to figure out or I have a problem that I'm doing, I will just start a series of question and answer dialogue with myself. Okay, what do I know about this? Did we do this situation? Okay, did we check in with this? Okay, where am I left with? And sometimes I'll even ask myself, okay, so you're feeling a little bit upset, you know, you're not really sure why. What did you sleep well? Okay. You know, did you wake up in the morning and did you eat? Okay. No, I skipped breakfast. Okay. Did you drink enough water? You know, I didn't really drink water. I immediately went to my coffee and I didn't drink water. And I'll just answer it. I'll ask myself these questions and I'll answer them out loud. I find that very therapeutic and helpful. And I'll just go through and I'll say, you know what? I'm in a grumpy mood. And I didn't even realize that the thing that's upsetting me is that I was on social media yesterday and I saw something negative that somebody wrote about something. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I didn't practice my morning routine in the morning here. And so now both physically and mentally, I feel a little bit strained. And just even me saying that out loud and acknowledging it is the first step of saying, okay, great. Now we know where things are at. What do you really need from here? Do you need a glass of water? Do you need to rest a little bit? How about some meditation right now? Or do you need to eat something? Even on something as simple as just being a little bit annoyed or disruptive, I find this tool is extremely helpful to get out of our head that tends to rationalize and say and jump to conclusions or make up stories and try to perpetuate the worry and anxiety and not want us to unpack it.
That's golden information. And I completely agree with you. One other thing that I've noticed too, and especially because, you know, we all have nights where we have been on call. So you've been on call. I look a little rough around the edges today because I've been up late and didn't have a chance to clean up. And so I ask myself, if I get irritated with one person, I let it go. But if I get irritated with two or three people in a row in one day, I'm like, Mark, what's wrong with you? You don't normally get irritated with two or three people. There's something going on. Have you had the same questions? Have you gotten some sleep? Are you in the post-call mode where you need to, you know, go take a nap, or what's going on? So it really is important to be able to say that. And I think you're talking a lot about, you know, the mindfulness of it is important. And meditation for me has been very important. I regularly meditate. I loved Dan Harris's book, 10% Happier. I use that app. It's the only app I've ever paid for. And it's a great app called the 10% Happier. And I've been a big believer in transcendental meditation in the past. I did that through high school. And I don't know if you know a guy named Dean Slider. He's out in LA. He's a great meditation teacher out there and written a couple of books as well.
And just on a practical note, how does, so you follow the app, and I think that the 10% Happier app is a great app. On a practical level, how does that meditation show up for you in the day? Is it something that you try to do in the morning? Do you do it before, you know, transition moments? Curious to see how it flows in your routine.
Always first thing in the morning, I will use it. So my morning routine is meditation, and then I have a filing system that I go to out of David Allen's Getting Things Done. It's a tickler file system, one number for every day that I open. And then I use a Franklin planner, which is a hard copy device that helps me see my day and my week and my month. So I use those three things every morning. And then I will use it sometimes in the afternoon if I'm taking a nap or something. They have great relaxation, you know, fall asleep apps to help with, or that's part of the app, sleep meditations. So it's been excellent. And there's some great courses on emotions and relationships. That it's a star-studded group of people on that app.
I'm curious, in the current state of the world, all things pandemic and COVID-19, how does a brain surgeon who's also a philosopher when it comes to fear look at this crisis? And what advice have you been sharing with people in this situation that we're in, that many of us find ourselves in, where you know, saw the latest numbers today, 40 million have filed for unemployment, 100,000 deaths, a lot of uncertainty. How do you look at what's happening right now and how we could potentially approach it and what we could potentially take away from the current times that we're in?
It's hit really home, really close. Unfortunately, my mom passed away of COVID complications a month ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. It is really it's a black swan for sure. No question. But my mind really, falls back on, and you know, I'm a big fan of Nassim Taleb and his book Anti-Fragile. And I mean, there's some things we should be thankful for. Like the SARS virus had a 20, 30, 40% mortality rate. This virus has a, you know, probably 1% mortality rate. I think it's a huge wake up call for our world now to know that, hey, we need to be able to crank out tests. We need to be able to know how to quarantine. We need to know how to social distance. And for me, and it's been obviously had a terrible impact on people's lives, on families, on businesses. But it could be so much worse if it was a more virulent virus. That we have gotten a really good wake up call, and the world is going to be different, but it'll be stronger. Will be stronger in the next 1 or 2 years because it's going to funnel a lot of research in how we can rapidly create vaccines for new viruses and how we can do the testing that needs to be done. So we were caught on our heels, no question, clearly ill-equipped in many different ways. I don't think it'll ever happen again, not in our lifetime. We'll be ready for anything serious.
Mm. And I think that's really the, when you understand fear and you understand philosophy and the human spirit, you know that human beings can take on so much and they're capable of so much. And sometimes the thing that looks like, and you talk about this in the book, sometimes the thing that looks like and is a very tragic thing. And again, I want to acknowledge, and I'm so sorry for your loss and your mother's passing. There can be elements out of that that help us as a society become more resilient, and tackle things in a new way, not always with the loss of a personal or individual, you know, that just has to be mourned and grieved. But as a society, we can take things away and can approach problems from a different perspective.
Exactly. And as my mom would have said, you know, don't let it happen again. And that's what she was, you know, she was a teacher for 40 years and, you know, we've got to never let this happen again. And, you know, be thankful that we had a virus that had a low mortality rate.
You know, just want to ask, you know, you mentioned your mom and did she have the chance to have, you know, your mom being a teacher and an educator, did she have a chance to read your book? And what did she think about your, you know, her son writing a book?
She loved the stories. You know, I told a number of stories about my grandfather when I was a young boy, and I would sit next to him and he would tell me the stories because he was a physician. And so she loved the stories. And, you know, my mom and dad were both thrilled that I was writing a book. Unfortunately, they passed before they could get a good deep dive into either of them. But they were proud of me.
That's beautiful. And of course they would be. You know, going back to where things are right now, you know, I remember in my preparation and research for this this podcast, I was reading different articles that you were featured in and listening to a few podcasts, and of course read the book immediately when I got my hands on it. And I remember seeing in one of the articles that I was looking at, you had an interview, and it was from the approach of, you know, brain surgeon, former Hall of Famer. I think it was NCAA or an article that was in association with them. And then you said inside of there, you said, you think my biggest and most difficult goal was to work on learning how to relax, is one of the quotes that you had shared inside of there in terms of where you want to make progress and one of the biggest challenges that's there for you. Have you made any improvement in the current times of the world slowing down? Has there been any ability to step into relaxation, and or is that still an ongoing challenge for you?
It is an ongoing challenge, but I have gotten better for sure. And I've been focusing on my reading a lot, and that has been helping me relax. So particularly with the elective cases being stopped for 2 months has allowed me to have more time to read. So I've been focusing on a lot of different books, and that's really kind of wet my whistle for more. I did a Ryan Holiday reading course, which was excellent, Daily Stoic reading course. And so I started, I've just been devouring a number of different books. 12 Rules for Life. I read Milton's Paradise Lost. I've read Grit and Grace. I've read Sam Harris's book, Waking Up. It's been very good for me to relax. Plus we got a dog, which has been great, good therapy for me to walk and think. So, one of my mentors has always said, you need to have more white space, in your life. And that is just blank time where you're just being creative, instead of doing something, you're just walking, you're thinking, driving without the radio on. So you have time to just think. So I have been able to do that, and I have been relaxing more. And as we all know, as I've relaxed more, I've become more productive, more effective in what I do. And you have to sharpen the saw to cut the trees down. You got to sharpen the saw.
So well said. Mark, here in conclusion, there's somebody that's listening to this podcast that's out there who is going through a tough time, or there's a really big fear that's there, that's in front of them. And so often they're, for all human beings, and for this person who's listening, there's this feeling of like, I've never been able to tackle this thing. I've tried in the past. I've done my best. What kind of hope do you want to leave that individual with when it comes to what you know about fear and the human spirit and resilience to tackle problems?
I would say that you can function effectively even in the face of failure. And what I mean by that is, sometimes I can't save somebody on the operating room table, and I have to be able to accept that. And I have to still function as a professional and do whatever needs to be done, whether that is to console a family in the right way with the right time and the right setting, and the right words, which, telling a family bad news is like doing an operation for me. It needs to be done perfectly, and it needs to be done with the precise words and the precise timing and delivery. So, we can function effectively in the face of failure, and we don't get better. In my opinion, you don't get better in leaps and bounds. You get better in shades. So, neurosurgery was a monumental task to tackle for me. And it happened very, very slowly on a day-to-day basis of trying to get better and better and better. As a writer, it happened on a day-to-day basis of continually writing, of learning new vocabulary, of reading other books, because if you can't be a good writer unless you're a good reader. So it's constantly taking in information and improving yourself, getting help in areas where your blind spots are. That's truly important too. And if you can help people shine light on your blind spot, and you can read a little bit about it, and you can practice it, some of the things that you failed at in the past, you can ultimately succeed with. And if you don't, you take it on head on, and you do the very best you can, and then you move on.
Beautiful. Dr. Mark, this has been fantastic, and I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast to share your wisdom. You have a quote in the beginning of your book by Socrates about, a life that's unexamined is not a life that's worth living. I might have butchered that quote a little bit over here, but basically the power of reflection and bringing that reflection to our life. And when I was reading your book, and I was thinking about these key times in my life where fear, at that moment, I felt got the best of me, and I wasn't sure how to navigate, or I avoided things, or I avoided my responsibilities, or I shut down, or I hid a little bit, and I recluded, which is natural, and this happened to many people, including, you've shared about how for a long time that even happened to you, and you were avoiding pediatric surgery. But when I was reading the book, and I was unpacking it, and really seeing the challenges I've gone through the framework that you presented, it gave me an opportunity to really examine my life and look at that and understand the fear for where it actually was useful, what I could, okay, I could do this better next time around, and really having the courage and the knowledge to know that I can show up stronger if I ever encountered that. So I want to thank you for putting together such a fantastic book and taking on a new journey. You went from wrestling to brain surgery to author. I'm excited to see where the journey takes you next.
I'm thrilled that the book was useful for you. And I'm just so happy that some of my experiences, I really truly believe, are universal, and they can definitely be looked at through other lenses, and lessons. These lessons are transferable to anyone in any business or walk of life.
Well, the best way to find out for yourself, audience, is to pick up a copy of the book. It's out there, Cognitive Dominance, A Brain Surgeon's Quest to Outthink Fear. You can find it in the show notes, including I'll include some other podcasts that I listened to that Mark was on that I found very exciting and very useful. Anywhere else that you'd like to direct our audience, Mark, that they can check out or explore some of the teachings, the lessons? Are you active on social media at all?
Sure. I have a website, markmclaughlinmd.com. And on that, there's actually a cognitive dominance assessment if you want to sort of assess where your skills are now. And it can give you some pointers on where you might be able to improve. And I do have a Instagram, mmclaughlinmd, and a Facebook and Twitter account as well, mmclaughlinmd. You can find me on there. I do write a blog, which is on the website. And I hope it's useful for you.
Fantastic. And we'll link to all that in the show notes there. Dr. McLaughlin, thank you again for being with us here on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.